Yeah, so thank you very much. Thanks for staying until 4 o'clock. It's been a pretty intense day. I would like to thank the organizers, Kerstin and Margaret. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here, and it's been a super interesting day. And I think I will follow Janice's advice in the morning, that one should say where one comes from and why one is here. And very briefly, I was born 2 hours away by plane from Antarctica, so maybe that's part of the motivation of this project. But that's Punta Arenas in Chile, and I studied philosophy, and that's my background. I did my PhD in global justice, but then I got interested in territorial rights. I've always been interested in territorial rights, coming from such an empty place like Patagonia. And this project, in a way, is trying to ask the big general questions in a specific place, which is Antarctica, but it's also a very special place and very sui generis. It's the last place on Earth where territorial claims are not settled. So you can still go there and make your claim first occupation, like Lockean fashion, pure Lockean fashion. So in that sense, it's really interesting. I'll jump straight into the matter. I'll say something about Antarctica for those of you who might not know anything about it, which could be many. You don't have to know about Antarctica. And then in this paper, what I try to do is to motivate the idea that there are four ways in which, maybe there are more, but at least four ways in which colonialism in Antarctica was white. It's a kind of playful paper. It's not the kind of paper I'm used to writing. It's actually very short. It's called A Critical Intervention for a Special Issue on the 60 Years of the Antarctic Treaty, which are it's just this year. So many things are grand claims that don't have much argument behind. I'm sorry for that, for those of you who read the paper, but I'll do my best to motivate those claims. So I'll start with a short quiz. And those who have been subjected to this before, don't say anything, please. But how many countries claim Antarctic territory?
Five.
Okay, go. What countries?
Australia.
Australia, 42% of the whole continent. Chile, there we go.
Argentina.
The
United States.
No, they have a potential claim, but they don't claim anything.
South Africa.
No, they are early participants, but not.
Britain.
Yes, UK, of course.
New Zealand.
Yes, well done. One more, two more to go. I forgot to say I work at the University of Oslo.
Norway
and France, so that's it. Well done, yeah. So those are the claims. There are three overlapping claims, which is Chile, Argentina, and the United Kingdom, and no wonder, it's the Antarctic Peninsula. It's the easiest and most accessible part of the continent. The part west of Chile is unclaimed, so that's where you can go and stake your claims if you're interested. What is the status of these claims today? Does anyone know? Well, maybe I've already told the answer. They're frozen. Which means, so long as a treaty lasts, these countries are not going to do anything with their claims. So sovereignty is frozen in Antarctica. But it's a special, it's a very interesting way in which it is frozen, because the countries internally are all the time saying Antarctica is a bit of our territory, there is sovereignty, for example, Chilean sovereignty over Antarctica, that's something that every Chilean takes for granted in a way. But for the international community, these claims are there, and they're suspended so long as a treaty is in force. And one last question, I think. When was the Antarctic Treaty signed? Well, I said it was 60 years. It was 1959. I'll give away that answer. And do you know how many countries are part of it? How many have signed this treaty? Only one African country, South Africa. Lots of European countries, increasingly more Asian countries, but it's 53, and the number is growing. Last question. Was Antarctica part of a colonial enterprise? Yes. Okay.
Of course.
Okay. Good. You're not surprised by that. Some people are surprised. Yeah, so because of time, I'm just going to assume this, and I'm happy that you agree with me. So Antarctica was part and parcel of the European colonial enterprise since the end of the 18th century, and not just European. So Japanese, for example, were also really interested in Antarctica. This was the whaling time, seal hunting. It was a resource frontier. So, yeah, I like that picture, but I like to say that that was exactly how they did it. Actually, in Antarctica, you can see that pie being cut much more clearly than in Africa. Okay, so I start from a very broad definition of colonialism, and I adapt this from Kohn. So I take it to be a practice of domination. Is it very? Yeah, sorry. A practice of domination through political and economic control over a territory, which standardly included the creation of settlements that kept their political allegiance to the colonizing power. Now you will see that there are no subjected individuals there, and some people start frowning because it's really strange. So if, you know, this was all there was in Antarctica. So if there were no indigenous populations, can we still call it colonialism? And what was wrong about colonialism in Antarctica? So this is a question that I want to pursue. If there was colonialism, but there were no indigenous populations, what was wrong? So one thing that was wrong, or maybe not wrong, but yes, it was wrong. But maybe I'm not so interested in this whiteness. So it was performed by white men and told, retold by white men, mostly, and until recently, white men and women. This has been largely explored by lots of very good feminist thinkers like Lisa Bloom and Elena Glassberg and Christy Collis, so I'm not going to dwell on that. So it's been largely documented that Antarctica is a place where white people went to take territory, to be discoverers and to push humanity forward. That's the Ice Maiden expedition from the UK very recently. As you can see, it's pretty white. And the terms, so when the treaty was signed, that's a picture of the day the treaty was signed in 1959, it was only white men. And one thing that is interesting is that some of the most important challenges to the treaty and to how it works have come from non-white sources. So Nehru, very early, before the treaty was signed, was already saying Antarctica should be internationalized, denuclearized, and demilitarized. But then something happened and nothing happened. So India just made this claim about how Antarctica should be governed, so be under the auspices of the UN, and it didn't work. More recently, in the 80s, that's Mohammed bin Mahathir, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and he started what was called the question of Antarctica in the United Nations. And basically this was saying, well, the 80s were the time when the countries that were part of the treaty wanted to have a convention for the exploitation of mineral resources in Antarctica. But then suddenly all that was put to an end in the 1990s, and instead we got an environmental protocol, which is very protective. But in the 80s, everyone was thinking, well, this is the next place to go and drill. So Mahathir was thinking, well, if they're going to do this, we all want to be part, so we want a fair share of the resources, everything that exploited there. And finally, very recently, the Chinese president has been talking about Antarctica and how Antarctica figures in Chinese politics and how it's going to be a really important strategic resource for the future. So that's the racial whiteness, which I think is kind of contingent to Antarctica. I'm more interested in the two whitenesses that come next. White space. So contrary to Australia, that was declared terra nullius. This was pretty nullius, actually, at least in terms of humans. There were lots of non-humans, but in terms of human habitation, there was nothing there. And as Adrian Hawkins puts it, I think it's very nice how he describes this, it was space, not people, that was at the center of the settler colonial project in Antarctica. And this was done for economic and strategic reasons, mainly. So there is this Chilean writer there holding a penguin in a tour in 1954, one of the first tours from the Chilean military to Antarctica. And he says, Chile must get ready to fulfill its mission in the Pacific era when possession of its Antarctic territory will be indispensable, because that territory and continental Chile form one and only geographic system of perfectly defined strategic and economic importance. So there is this idea that we need to take space. And it is white space. I call it white because it's empty. Well, and it's pretty white. But then there is, yeah, this is the whiteness where I think I want to say more. Carte blanche. So if you know the expression, it's basically a blank card, literally, but it's something done with full discretionary power. And I use this to, in a way, reflect how the claims were made and how politics in general has been conducted in Antarctica. So I would say there are like three carte blanche moments in this colonial project. So the first thing was the unilateral claiming of these ridiculously big amounts of territory. And this was started by the UK in 1908 with a letter patent, which, as a very ingenious writer said, was as inept in intention as ungrammatical in expression. They included a bit of Chile and Argentina. They did it so rashly, so they had to reissue it in 1917. But the other countries followed, and actually Chile and Argentina did not want to be left behind. So they did not appeal to a letter patent, but they appealed to the Treaty of Tordesillas, 1494, signed only by two countries, Portugal and Spain, dividing the new world between them. And according to this principle of uti possidetis, where the administrative borders are retained when the colonies gain independence, they thought, well, you know, Antarctica, so the Spanish crown had claimed all the way to the pole, even though they had never been there. They didn't even know that there was Antarctica at the time. Still, we retained that claim, and therefore, now that we're independent, we have a claim over over that piece that would have belonged to the Spanish crown. And that's the ground of their claims. So it's this creating of rules, ex nihilo, basically, that I find very interesting. There is also so that would be like the first moment. So this creation of, the unilateral claiming, it's this first moment. Then there is this creation of the Antarctic Treaty that was also made, not unilaterally, oligolaterally. So it was 12 countries that signed this treaty. And they represented only 4% of the total population of the world at the time. There were 12 countries out of 82, I think it was the number of countries part of the United Nations at the time. And they said, they explicitly say in the preamble, they are going to be the guardians. They're going to protect Antarctica for the good of mankind. And this is quite paternalistic in a way, because if you think about it, like Nehru said, well, why not internationalize this territory? Why does it have to be 12 countries that protect it for the future? So I think that that's a carte blanche moment too. And finally, the last thing that I would like to describe as having this discretionary power that subjects others in a way that is not reciprocal, that doesn't treat them as equals, is how the treaty is maintained. So there are two categories of members. There are those who vote, that's 29 countries today, and the rest. Anyone can join the treaty, so that's what everyone who loves the treaty will tell you. The treaty is open, any country can sign. Like if the African countries haven't signed, well, they can come at any minute and sign, why not? The problem is that to really have power of decision, you need to conduct substantial science, and that is expensive. So at the end of the day, it's only rich countries, or countries that are really willing, like Chile and Argentina, that have science in Antarctica enough to be considered voting parties. And I find that problematic too. So that's the Treaty of Tordesillas dividing. So that's the line dividing Spain to that side and Portugal to that side. The New World was going to be divided by them like that. Yeah, and this is a magpie because I read in the dictionary that acting as a magpie has this meaning of being hoarding and acquisitive and over like trying to take as much as you can. And I think that metaphor describes very well how I think they were acting. So it's like really taking much more than what anything could justify in an empty space. The last whiteness is how all this was sold as a very innocent adventure. So from the very beginning, so the expeditions by Scott and Amundsen being portrayed as these heroes, like showing the best of humanity. But still today, the Antarctic Treaty is celebrated as this piece of international cooperation where countries have managed to preserve the environment and they have managed to keep it denuclearized and to a certain extent depoliticized. But there are also tensions, and there are increasing tensions here that I think they cannot just ignore. So why care? So why is this problematic? yeah, what does the whiteness add to the wrong of this colonialism? And I think that, as I said before, I think the two whitenesses that are interesting from a normative perspective are this taking of the huge expanses of land that were unoccupied, and these unequal terms in the creation, in the establishment, and in the upholding of the treaty system. And in a context where people are already thinking that in 2048, I don't know if you've heard that year, but many think that that's the end of the treaty, and that that's when everyone goes and takes whatever they can, so resources for up for grabs. That's not the case, actually. 2048 is a year when the environmental protocol may be revised, so there is currently a mining ban in Antarctica, but in 2048, that could be revised if some of the countries asks for a revision. But China is very interested, Korea is very interested, Ukraine has explicitly said that they're interested in doing science to know what kind of resources there are. So I think there's going to be increasing interest, and if the treaty system wants to hold its legitimacy, it's very important to acknowledge openly that this was the genesis of the thing. I don't think it helps to say this was all clad in white from the very beginning and it was all a very innocent adventure and we're all the guardians of humankind in Antarctica. I think that's not going to be enough. So in a way, it's pushing them to make explicit these colonial origins and to recognize the implications of that. I don't think, how much time do I have? So the last thing I say in this paper, but I don't develop at all, it's, I think this idea, this concept of white colonialism, as in taking empty space with a discretionary attitude, could be used to think about other spaces. So the deep seabed is one, and outer space is definitely another. And here we'd love to have the guidance of a lawyer who explains to me this Space Resource Exploration and Utilization Act of 2015. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it was like one of the last things that Obama signed. And it basically says, a US citizen engaged in commercial recovery of an asteroid resource or a space resource shall be entitled to any asteroid resource or space resource obtained, including to possess, own, transport, use, and sell it according to applicable law, including US international obligations. Now, the US says that this does not violate the Outer Space Treaty, which says that outer space is common heritage of mankind. And here, I think that what they're actually doing is laying down the rules for how outer space resources are going to be harvested and used and exploited and profited from. So I think that this idea of white colonialism is worth pursuing. This is a preliminary exploration, but I would be very happy to discuss further. So thanks a lot. Thank you.